From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, the last of the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
How many cops of the hundreds who beat, brutalize, or kill people all across this land are ever prosecuted for their acts? How many are convicted? The numbers are minuscule. The widely reported Rodney King beating case showed us how judges bend over backwards to assure criminal cops that things will be taken care of and they won't be hurt badly if sentenced. The white majority media treat cop stealings as worse offenses than cop killings, and by so doing, seek to minimize those acts in the public mind.
Tomorrow is International Women's Day. We have the stories of two women. First, Silvia Baraldini, an Italian political activist imprisoned here in the United States. There's outcry in Italy.
What is not known in your country is that the case of Silvia Baraldini, of this continued imprisonment in the United States, has unleashed a real emotional wave in Italian public opinion. In the last 9 years, there have been hundreds of demonstrations, sit-ins in front of the United States Embassy in Rome, in front of the consul offices in other towns. There have been press and television campaigns. There have been debates with the participation of government people, jurists, intellectuals, and resolutions have been passed by the Italian Parliament.
Anne Bella Gallios, a young Timorese woman, tells her story.
So when I went to the jail to see my brother, and we couldn't even recognize him because he's completely, they beat him up probably like every day or something. Like his face, not my brother anymore. Like he's not human. Like he, at the time, he's just like a monkey. Like completely looks like a monkey. And he couldn't even put his finger, like he's shaking because of all of his fingernails out, and his body was blood, the blood that come out from his head, come to his body, was really dark and smelly, and he's just terrible. Like, the way they treat him at the time is really, really unhuman.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today we hear our final commentary from journalist and death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal. He was convicted in 1982 of the killing of police officer Daniel Faulkner. The Pennsylvania State Supreme Court is now considering whether to grant him a new trial.
I am Justice Bruce Wright, a retired state Supreme Court justice here in New York. Law and order were the twin cries of Adolf Hitler at one time. Hitler's final solution for the Jews proved, if any proof was needed, that all too often law has little or nothing to do with justice. And law and order is the cry heard throughout America today. Politicians win elections by standing in the jailhouse door in their commercials, promising that that is where they will excommunicate all criminals. Each day, our prison population increases. One out of every 163 citizens are in prison. The highest rate of imprisonment in the world. The more the politicians threaten to stop crime and imprison criminals, the more crime we have.
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African American. I live in the fastest growing public housing tract in America. I've been a resident on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 15 years. Philadelphia, New York, New Orleans, Los Angeles. In city after city, we find case after case of not only police corruption, but vicious police violence. Young people are beaten, women are assaulted. People who are taught to believe police are their friends find out they are often deadly enemies armed with the power of the state. In city after city, police corruption scandals blare across the front pages, telling us of cops who moonlight as drug dealers, sowing the seeds of social poison from their squad cars. The media react with manufactured outrage, and the cycles of corruption reoccur again, again, and again. The recent Mullen Commission hearings held in New York City were but viler, more corrupt echoes of the Knapp Commission hearings into cop corruption a generation before. Cops caught stealing, thieving, and or robbing excite the public mind. But what of cops who brutalize, beat, or kill? How many cops of the hundreds who beat, brutalize, or kill people all across this land are ever prosecuted for their acts? How many are convicted? The numbers are minuscule. The widely reported Rodney King beating case showed us how judges bend over backwards to assure criminal cops that things will be taken care of and they won't be hurt badly if sentenced. The white majority media treat cop stealings as worse offenses than cop killings, and by so doing, seek to minimize those acts in the public mind. Thus, it is the contention of many cops charged with such offenses that they were only doing their job. Put quite another way, their jobs are to kill, to beat, to brutalize the poor and the powerless, to defend the interests of the rich. That's what they are telling you. When the human rights group Amnesty International recently released a report denouncing New York police brutality against that city's African American and Latino communities, the white majoritarian media and police hierarchy downplayed it as if the Nobel Prize-winning group was interfering. The interests of white majoritarian media converge with the interests of predominantly white police forces in the protection of the status quo. That status quo is, in America, white supremacy and the oppression of peoples of color. And to protect that status quo, it is necessary to look the other way when cops beat, lie on the stand, brutalize the poor and the powerless, or even kill. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And with that last piece, we end our two-week series of commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal, newly recorded this past October at the SCI Green Correctional Facility in Pennsylvania. As you know, if you've been listening to this series, he was recorded in October when he was shackled and behind plexiglass by the Prison Radio Project, the group that we were working with to get these commentaries. The airing of these commentaries has caused a great deal of controversy. There have been pieces in papers all over the country, from the Washington Post to the Philadelphia Inquirer to the New York Times. And the reason it is so controversial is this is the first time that these commentaries have been aired. It's the first time that commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal have been aired since National Public Radio canceled the series they were going to run because of tremendous pressure they got from the Fraternal Order of Police. As a result of this controversy, Temple University canceled its contract with Pacifica Radio for airing these commentaries. They wrote that to us in a letter. And we've been getting calls all week from people expressing their support or their lack of support for what we have chosen to do, and that is air these commentaries. And so we wanted to play some of the many calls that we've been getting throughout the week.
This is Carl in Fremont, California. I listen to KPFA, and I'd like to say, God bless America, land of the free. Stand beside her and guide her. Whoops, I'm sorry. Temple University doesn't honor that anymore. They've decided to cancel Pacifica Radio. They've turned the Constitution over on its head, and our founding fathers of this great nation are turning over in their graves. I'm appalled at what they've done. I'm ashamed of what they've done, and I hope the rest of America is ashamed of what they've done. Mumia Abu-Jamal deserves to be heard just like any other person who has been framed and unjustly put in prison. I speak for him and everybody else. Temple University has got to come back to reality.
Hi, my name is Rosemary Taft. I'm calling from Los Angeles, California, and I would like to make a comment on the Abu-Jamal commentary. I consider myself rather a liberal person, but I have had a direct experience in my life where a friend, my cousin, close friend, was murdered. We've never found the person who was had murdered her. I tend to feel that Americans are much too lenient on their criminals. I know it must be terrible to be put in jail if you actually haven't done the crime that they're accusing you of, but I think that criminals should lose their rights. I think that's one of the threats that criminals should know, that if they are caught and put in jail, they basically lose their inalienable rights for the time being that they're incarcerated. So I don't feel that Abu Jamal has a right to air his feelings on the radio.
Alvin X from L.A., I heard your commentary over KPFK. Today is the 6th of March. The subject is Mumuy Jamal. He has every right to speak. I'm against censorship. Free speech extends to black men, especially when I hear only safe comments from the likes of Jesse Jackson or the NAACP or the Urban League, safe black organizations. I hear insensitive and racist remarks quite often from white commentators such as G. Gordon Liddy, Rush Limbaugh, and Howard Stern. They aren't censored. They're even praised. So why this censorship effort against black men?
Amy Goodman's shows are one-sided, lopsided, and represent everything that is contrary to the way that I was raised. Amy Goodman really contributes nothing to the debate, but she can sure tear the system apart that's here. She didn't help build it, but when it's all gone, she's going to be a victim of whatever's next. I really don't think that I can, because of Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! And its lopsided presentation of opinions, I can't honestly contribute to public radio, because I can't contribute to something that tears down everything, that tears down the whole establishment that I stand for. The victims of this man should have a chance to speak. To me, Amy Goodman represents everything that's wrong with this country.
My name is Helene McDonald Kampelmüller. I'm calling from Boulder in Colorado. I'm a listening member of KGNU, so I'm able to listen to some of Radio Pacifica's programs. I especially enjoy Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. She's doing a wonderful job, and I'm looking forward to this program every morning. It's very educational, and I feel always very inspired and motivated. I also would like to express my respect that you're airing Mumuy Abu-Jamal's commentaries. It takes a lot of courage, especially in this time when it's becoming more and more difficult that non-mainstream or oppressed people can express their opinion. And keep on doing such good work. It is very appreciated. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Scott.
Just some of the calls that we have been getting over the last week as we've been airing the commentaries of Mumuy Abu-Jamal. We welcome calls and comments, and we encourage you to continue to call into our comment line on the programs that you hear and the programs you'd like to hear. Our phone number is 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. And by the way, once again, we did invite the Fraternal Order of Police of Philadelphia to join us. We also asked if Maureen Faulkner, the wife of the man who was murdered, Daniel Faulkner, the police officer in 1981, would be able to join us. She has never gotten back to us, and the Fraternal Order of Police said that they would only talk if she was on the air, yet they were the means through which we could reach her, and she has not called us back. So we are very sorry about that. You're listening to Democracy Now! Now we move on to another subject. Tomorrow, March 8th, is International Women's Day. And to mark the event, we're going to hear about the experiences of two women activists, one from Italy and one from Indonesian-occupied East Timor. First, we're going to hear about the case of Silvia Baraldini, a 42-year-old woman presently serving a 40-year prison sentence in Danbury, Connecticut. Few Americans have heard her name, but in Western Europe, and especially in Italy, her case is a hot political issue. We first turn to Elizabeth Fink, Silvia Baraldini's attorney. Elizabeth Fink, why don't we start by you telling us just who Silvia Baraldini is? Just give us background on her case.
Silvia Baraldini is an Italian woman who was brought to this country by her parents in 1960, when she was essentially 12, 13, 14 years old. She grew up in the United States. She went to the University of Wisconsin, starting there in 1965, and became part of the civil rights movement and SDS and the anti-Vietnam War movement that was extremely strong at Wisconsin. She came out and was a full-time activist, working part-time for much of her life. and she was a member of the May 19th Communist Organization. She worked on the Panther 21 case in the early 70s. She founded a woman's school. So essentially she was a political activist. And she was arrested on November 9th of 1982 on the Upper West Side, about 100th Street and Broadway, and without incident and without any weapons, and charged with being a member of the conspiracy who participated in the Brinks robbery of October of 1981, and which was a rather infamous robbery which took place in Nanuin and Nyack, New York, in which two police officers and a Brinks guard were killed. As a part of the conspiracy, she was never charged with any of the robberies or any actions which resulted in any harm or any death to anyone. She was charged essentially with two actions. One, driving a getaway car in the escape of Assata Shakur, who was a member of the Black Liberation Army and the Black Panther Party, who was arrested on the New Jersey Turnpike in 1973 and charged with a number of bank robberies and the murder of a trooper at the time of her arrest. She was acquitted of all the bank robberies and then convicted in rural New Jersey in front of a white racist jury, sentenced to life imprisonment. 1979, she was freed in a rather spectacular escape in which no one was injured, and she's living free and productive in Havana, Cuba right now. And so she was charged with being a getaway driver in that escape, and she was charged with being going on an attempted robbery which never took place. She was tried in federal court. She was convicted in 1984 and sentenced by Kevin Duffy, who was the judge in the World Trade Center case and all these other cases, what one would refer to as a rather difficult judge, to the maximum sentence, which is 40 years imprisonment and a big fine. She was then also subpoenaed to a grand jury. She refused to cooperate. She got another 3 years. She began to serve her federal sentence in 84. She was a person who was placed in the government's experiment in sensory deprivation and small group isolation torture. There was a movie about it called Through the Wire that people might have seen, and they would have seen Sylvia in that movie. She contracted cancer in that unit. She's had two operations, and she's been in prison going on her 15th year.
That prison is called the Lexington Prison?
It was. It was shut down because of Amnesty International and a lot of church protests, a lot of public protests, and in 1988. And from there, she went to New York and then to Mariana, Florida, which is, you know, about 80 miles due west of Tallahassee, in this other very small unit. And finally, now she's in the federal prison for women in Danbury, Connecticut. She's in remission from the cancer. And a lot of really terrible things have happened to her and her family. Her sister, who was a middle-level bureaucrat for the European Economic Community, participating and running their AIDS work in Africa, was killed when her plane that she was traveling in was blown up by the Islamic Jihad over Chad in 1989. And in 1989, the Italian government made their first application to repatriate her pursuant to an international treaty called the Strasbourg Convention, which the United States has been a signer with for decades, which gives people the right who are not citizens of this country to apply to the United States and to their native land to do their prison sentence. That's all they're asking, is to go to prison in their native country. And Sylvia, the Italian government applied for Sylvia beginning in 1989, and there have been four rejections by the United States government of this application, two by Clinton and two by Bush. So we've had this campaign for a long time, and At the moment, she's done 15 years. She's going to go to the parole board in July. She's been eligible for parole for a very long time. And we have a campaign around getting her on parole, then sending her back to Italy that way, or to get the Americans to agree to repatriate her pursuant to the Strasbourg Convention.
Elizabeth, think we have to break, but when we come back, we're going to finish hearing from you and find out what the Strasbourg Convention is, and then go to a member of the European Parliament, Lucio Menisco, and find out what's happening in Italy. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the case of Silvia Baraldini, we're joined by Elizabeth Fink, Silvia Baraldini's attorney, as well as Lucio Menisco, who is an Italian member of the European Parliament based in Strasbourg, France. But we are talking to you now in Rome, Italy. You're also a member of the, what do you call it, the Communist Refoundation Party?
Well, I call my party, I mean, this is the name of my party is the Party of Communist Refoundation. As it doesn't sound well enough in English, I call myself a born-again communist. So, never mind. What is not known in your country is that the case of Silvia Baraldini, of this continued imprisonment in the United States, has unleashed a real emotional wave in Italian public opinion. In the last 9 years, there have been hundreds of demonstrations, sit-ins in front of the United States Embassy in Rome, in front of the consul offices in other towns. There have been press and television campaigns. There have been debates with the participation of government people, jurists, intellectuals, and resolutions have been passed by the Italian Parliament, by the Senate, also by the European Parliament in Strasbourg. All these movements, all these moves requesting the United States government to transfer Silvia to an Italian jail pursuant to the Strasbourg Convention of the Ms. Fink was talking about. And, of course, five different Italian governments since 1989 have asked Washington to no avail to observe this Strasbourg Convention.
What is the Strasbourg Convention?
This is a treaty. Signed by the United States, ratified by the United States and by practically all the European countries and some other countries, which allows citizens in foreign countries, let's say in the case of Serbia, an Italian citizen, sentenced to jail in the United States, to spend the rest of their sentences in the country of origin, in their native country. It is true that the convention is not mandatory. It doesn't impose this type of transfer to a national jail. But it was done for the purpose of eliminating this also this type of difference in the in the administration of justice, and to allow these foreign citizens to leave the United States and to spend the rest of their jail sentences in their countries. They've been ratified by the Italian government, by the United States, by the United States Congress, and of course the United States keeps saying that her crimes are so horrible that she cannot. She cannot be transferred following the convention. Anyway, what is important over here is that the movement for Silvia to obtain a repatriation is growing by the day. Cities like Venice, Palermo, Naples, Genoa, have given her their honorary citizenship. Two presidents of the Republic have appealed personally to two presidents of the United States, George Bush and Bill Clinton. They appealed for an act of clemency on humanitarian grounds. It is my personal opinion that maybe the Italian authorities should have done more, should have been more firm and determined when confronted by the United States Justice Department intransigence. But that's my opinion, not shared by all in my country. There's been a sort of subservient attitude typical of that limited sovereignty, which many right-wing people in my country accept or even enjoy in any dispute with the United States. Anyway, it is years and years that I've been confronted with the same question by people who are very friendly towards the United States. And the question is, why? Why the United States government is acting this way? Why is feeding year after year, tension, misunderstanding to the Italian people on an issue that all things considered, quite frankly, is very marginal, if not irrelevant, for the United States' prestige or its foreign policy? Let me say that many people in my country, people who haven't followed closely the case of Sylvia, imagine that she might have committed some heinous crime, maybe mass murder or blowing up a building like in Oklahoma City. They just can't believe that she has no blood on her hands, that she's been punished and persecuted, I would say, simply because she's an intellectual, she's a Marxist who sided up with the cause of Afro-Americans in the 70s, early 80s. For many of these people, it came as a shock to read in the Corriere della Sera, that is the equivalent in Italy of the New York Times, an interview with Assata Shakur. Assata Shakur is the lady that Ms. Fink was talking about before, who lives in Cuba now, in which Assata exonerated at least partially Sylvia from any direct active responsibility in her escape from an American jail. So the result is that United States authorities are acting in the case of Sylvia in a very counterproductive way. They are not serving the national interest, and they are poisoning the relationship with a country that is an ally, a friendly country like Italy.
Lucio Minisco, let me ask you this. You're a member of the European Parliament. What is it doing about the case of Sylvia Baraldini?
What am I doing in the European Parliament?
Yes, so what is the Parliament?
We have been agitating the issue, but it's not only a communist, the Italian communist case. I mean, there are right-wing parliamentarians, Italian parliamentarians, who signed all this petition. And in April, for the third time, we are going to pass, and I'm sure unanimously in European Parliament in Strasbourg, another resolution, another petition asking the United States government to apply, to follow, to observe the Strasbourg Convention and to ship her back to an Italian jail. It's as simple as that.
If Sylvia Baraldini were shipped back to an Italian jail, would they free her?
No. She will probably have to spend a few years in Italian jail, and that is obviously she's not going to spend another 30 years because Italian laws are not even considering the such incredible severe sentences for somebody who hasn't committed murder. Probably she would have to spend six or five years in an Italian jail, and I have to remind you that not only in Italy but in Germany, we have been very clement with all people who are involved with the Red Brigades, with the Baader Meinhof in Germany, and people who have, for their own political ideologies and so on, they have committed some murder and so on. There are very few people left in jails. For instance, many people they have been accused and sentenced for the assassination of Moro. They are out now. They have limited freedom, but they are not in jail. So So that's why there is this misunderstanding. People in Italy do not understand why the United States is so impervious to any kind of humanitarian sort of principle and so on. Why do they refuse to apply this convention?
Let me end this conversation with Elizabeth Fink. Can you tell us exactly what is the timetable for the parole board to consider parole for Sylvia Baraldini?
Well, you know, the situation with the parole is that parole has been abolished in the federal system now since 1987. And since Sylvia was convicted before 87, she's still eligible. So the parole board is a much smaller operation than it used to be. She's going to go in front of the board in July, and we expect a decision from them sometime in September. At the same time, we're asking the Italian government to use a provision in the treaty called Article 23, which is calls for informal arbitration in the Committee on Penal Affairs of the Council of Europe. This is part of the treaty. The United States has signed it. And we are asking Italy to take the United States into an international forum, because all this has been done by letter, and it's all private and it's all quiet. And given the enormous support she has in Italy and the support she has in Europe, it would be incumbent upon the United States to explain why, after 15 years, someone who has no history of violence has to serve this onerous prison sentence, you know, having had cancer and having had all this tragedy in her life, when she should be sent back to Italy, save the taxpayers' money, and end the case.
How does her case, how does the length of time she has served compare to others in prison?
Well, it compares to the other political prisoners that are in American jails, right? Because people who are in American jails for committing acts in support of black liberation or Puerto Rican independence find themselves locked away for the maximum sentence that they can, 87 years, 56 years, enormous periods of time. As I said before, if she was a social prisoner, if she went to the parole board, her guidelines for which she should have been released were less than 7 years in prison. Because if you take into account what she was charged with and what was she convicted of, right, the relevant conduct, as it's called, is such that her prison sentence should have been less than 10 years. She's now in her 15th year with no end in sight, except by release on parole. And the parole board, being a political body and a representative of the law enforcement office, is not inclined to represent and to release those people who have chosen extra legal means in support of their politics.
Elizabeth Fink, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Elizabeth Fink, an attorney based in New York City, she is the attorney for Sylvia Baraldini. We've also been joined by Lucio Menisco, who is an Italian member of the European Parliament based in Strasbourg, France. If you want to find out more about the case of Sylvia Baraldini, you can go to the World Wide Web. You can just put in her name, Sylvia Baraldini, and put it into a search engine, and you'll find out information on her. There is an actual website at www.unix.oit.umass/edu/DMCP. That's the little squiggly line, DMCP. And there is an address, the Committee to Return Sylvia Baraldini to Italy, P.O. Box 02-1140, Brooklyn, New York, 11201. That's Committee to Return Sylvia Baraldini to Italy, P.O. Box 02-1140, Brooklyn, New York, 11201. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and after this bit of a music break, we're going to come back and hear the story of another woman, this on the day before International Women's Day, a young woman from East Timor.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough.
No politician bent enough.
To bury your story, to keep it from us.
Bury your story and keep it from us.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
You're listening to the music of a CD called Love from a Short Distance, compilation CD for the children of East Timor. Well, there's been a lot of news about the campaign finance scandals in Washington and the money ties of foreign dictatorships to President Clinton. But buried in all the noise are the stories of individual men and women living under brutal military regimes that are supported by U.S. military and financial aid. One story is that of Isabella Gallios, a 24-year-old East Timorese woman who's just sought political asylum in Canada. She recently spoke before the Massachusetts state legislature, where she asked lawmakers to cut all ties with companies doing business with Indonesia, which has occupied East Timor for the last 22 years since its invasion of December 7, 1975. The Massachusetts state legislature is actually considering a bill to cut off all ties to businesses who are working in Indonesia. Bella Gallios is also just finished a national speaking tour here in the United States, sponsored by Global Exchange and the East Timor Action Network. She survived the Indonesian military's massacre of 250 people at a peaceful demonstration in Dili, East Timor, back in 1991. And even though I was there at the time covering the procession that led to the massacre, I didn't know that Bella Gallios was there or even who she was. She was just one of thousands of students protesting the death of a young man killed by the Indonesian military 2 weeks before, named Sebastio Gomez. Like many East Timorese, after the massacre, Bella Gallios went to the home of the, well, now Nobel Peace Prize winner. He just won the Nobel Peace Prize this past December, Bishop Carlos Jimenez Bello, to find out what happened to her family members. I caught up with her at the end of her national speaking tour. This is her story.
Well, I was born November 10, 1972, and when Indonesia invaded my country, I was just 3 years old. You know, human rights being abused, people are tortured or killing, disappearance is still going on in East Timor. And I'm witness so many of my friends, relatives that physically and mentally abused by Indonesian military. So that's just the things I've seen as a young person. And I also still remember when I was young, I have to pretend to be Indonesian child. That's the only way to prevent, you know, physically tortured by Indonesian military in our house, because our house also being occupied by Indonesia in 1975. And I also remember, you know, watching my parents crying because of two of my brothers, and powerlessly but have to accept that reality that two of them die. And I also remember the story of my parents about my uncles and aunties that been killed because of my uncle was some military under Portuguese colony. So this kind of things I heard when I was about 13 years old.
You were in the procession in 1991 that the Indonesian military opened fire on. Can you talk a little about that? First, why were you there?
Well, the reason I was there because I didn't really know Sebastian Gomez personally, but we came from same school, and then at the time when the killing of Sebastian Gomez really awake everybody, it's really touched every young people in East Timor, and it was hard for everyone, like young people like us, to accept that reality that is going on, for young people have to die so early, and young people been tortured and disappeared so many times in East Timor just because of their pro-independence for their country. So it's too much already. So at the time, we know that foreign journalists were there, and it's really rare to see foreign journalists in East Timor. So voluntarily, we also helped from my high school to volunteer that, to make it happen, the demonstration. Like, you know, we giving some kind of like money or things that we could able to give to all of the young people who's prepared banners or anything like that. So this time we take Sebastian Gomez as an example of what happened to other young people. And also we know that Portuguese parliamentarian came to East Timor to visit East Timor to see what has happened in East Timor. And so we want to make that happen, that people know exactly what's going on in East Timor. So, like, at the time, like, thousands, and I think probably you know that, it's like thousands people of East Timor were there, especially young people, men, women, and children, we all there. And we didn't realize that, we didn't think that they would open a fire on us because of the foreign journalists were there. But what we thought is completely different. They didn't even care if journalists were there. They still opened a fire, and it was really shock everyone. But we did it. We finally, this demonstration that turned to massacre by Indonesian military brought the reality about East Timor. And it is said that people know about East Timor through 1991, not from 1975, that they're the place where it started, a hundred massacre happened. And it's pity that people know about East Timor through 1991 massacre. But this massacre happened in East Timor since 1975.
Bella Gallios will continue our conversation with her in just a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by Bella Gallios, a 24-year-old East Timorese woman who has just gotten, defected to Canada in the last few years from East Timor. She survived the massacre of 1991. Bella, that's where we left you. Where were you on November 12, 1991, in that procession in which the Indonesian military opened fire?
I pulled myself out from all of those people who tried to get into the cemetery, because I was still outside when they opened a fire. So I was trying to jumping in, and to jumping in is so easy, not so easy, because everybody tried to get into the cemetery so they can escape the wall. I was lucky to pull myself out from the crowd. So I was able to escape in, but I lost everything. I lost my shoes, and all of my dress was completely terrible because I ran. And I ran right to the east. So I didn't know where I was run. Like, I just ran like crazy. So I ran about, I was hiding for three days in some house in Bekora for about 3 days. And, of course, my family thought I was one of those who were killed in that cemetery. And when I came home after 3 days, they were really happy. But they were not really happy because my oldest brother was taken away from our home because of he got, you know, some of our friends was captured in the cemetery, been tortured so badly, so they opened, they telling about his name. He's also involved, made T-shirt Free East Timor. So it was hard, and me and my mother, we trying to find out where he was at the time. So we went to Bishop Bellot's house to make a report, and when I got there, I realized that 100 mothers there. Like, they're all waiting for Bishop Bellot that possibly could help them to find their son, their daughter, their husband. That's the time I see all of the mother gathered together, and many of them are crying, and the pain that they kept from 1975 started to come out at the time. And as a young person who see that, it's really moved. Like, I couldn't take that. And I realized that not just my mother that faced something that's going on in 1975, but all of mothers they here. Like, and that's really like something big for me, that I couldn't let this happen as a young daughter at the time. And after 3 days, finally Bishop Bellot could help us to went to the jail to see my brother. So when I went to the jail to see my brother, and we couldn't even recognize him, because he's completely, they beat him up probably like every day or something. Like, his face is not my brother anymore. Like, he's not human. Like, he, other time, he's just like a monkey. Like, completely looks like a monkey. And he couldn't even put his finger, like, he's shaking because of all of his fingernails out. And his body was blood. The blood that come out from his head, come to his body, was really dark and smelly. And he's just terrible. Like, the way they treat him at the time is really, really unhuman. Like, I was really not, it's really shocked and very sad and deep inside.
You said that his fingernails were pulled out?
Yeah, the reason they pulled his fingernails, he told us about how they pulled them out. They tried to get him to speak more, to get information about guerrilla's movement or about anything that he knows, about how many people involved in that demonstration, about how many people that organized the demonstration. Well, he didn't even know those people. And then really, he didn't really involve that much. He's helping out. And because of the question that he couldn't answer, he lost one by one of his fingernails by one question. And then they put him under the water for a long time, and he couldn't breathe. And they put him out and then put him back. And the way he pulled his fingernails out, they used chair. They asked him to put his fingernails under here, and the military sit down on the chair. And they sit down, about two, three of them, and sit down and do like this, and his fingernails pulled out. And when they did that, like, he told us about that. When they did it, they laughed and they screaming happy, while my brother was screaming terrible, like terribly hurt. And then they asked him to put up his arms, and then they hit him with brooms in his armpit, like, and then here also have a lot of hole in it because they asked him to do that. And his body was burned with cigarettes so many times, and then blood, like, you know, his skin is burned everywhere. And his ears is shocked with electricity, and also his genital, like things like that is going on. And he came home with terrible shape. Like, he would take about 3-4 months to got him back, but he couldn't think longer as he did before. He didn't really, you know, many times he's still in a condition where he think of what happened to him, torture that going on, and he's really scared of even talk about politics. And, you know, is that something that's going to stay with him forever, how they did that? And I took my brother as an example of what happened to other young men.
After the initial killings at the cemetery, were people killed who were arrested?
Well, after the journalists left, that's the hard time for all of young person, when people in East Timor, where randomly Indonesian military came to every houses to take more young people that they suspect. And also in the same time, to make security in your house, you have to adopt two Indonesian military in your house so that you're not going to organize anything anymore to against Indonesian government. And that's really hard for anybody to even talk or to even, you know, we have to behave perfectly because the military are around all the time. And let's take about, I was there on any time, and then they're mostly looking for family who has a daughter, and, you know, so they stay in your house to make sure that you're not organizing anything, you're not talking against the government, or you're not looking for members of family that die. You also, you know, I feel like sex harassed all the time. Yeah.
Are you saying that the military slept in your house?
Yeah, they stay in your house. They stay 24 hours. Sometimes they stay, sometimes they not stay. That's the time in 1991. And this is up to close to 1992, and then they just come to visit. They come anytime they want, at night, whatever, 11, 12, 1. They just come anytime just to check. So they check you every day, and they have to write your name in the door to see that how many family live in that house, what we're doing, and if we go out, for example, at the time, people are not leaving the house after 8 o'clock at night time. It's a curfew started. And people who travel into other village have to get a permission, like more. Before, we have to get a permission in 1975 until 80, something like that. But in 1991, it's getting more tight that if you go to the village, why you go, who that you go, how many people inside the car go, like, make us clear. So, and then how many, like, how long did you go for? You have to write down everything, and they will give the permission to you. And as soon as you go to the area, you have to make a report 24 hours, so the military in that area know that you're in that city for that long, and then will come back in this time. And then in every lonely street, you have to make a report every 15, 20 minutes of driving. So you have you're supposed to make it 3 hours to your village. You make it 5 hours just because of the report too much. Military here, military there, like every 5, 15 minutes, you have to get out from your car, make a report. And to make a report, you also have to read the Indonesian anthem, national anthem. You have to know how to sing it. And you have to remember Pancasila, the five principles of the Republic of Indonesia, out of your head. You have to say that. And many young, older people who are don't even know how to read, they don't even know how to read, they have to know it too. And they don't know, they torture them. They beat them up with their big boats, and so that's happening.
Are you saying that you have to stop at the checkpoints sing the Indonesian national anthem?
Yeah, I have to sing it, and you have to, and after you sing, just to make sure that you really, know about Indonesia, you really love Indonesia. Because I did it, because since I was in school, I did it every Monday. Like, every Monday I have to have a ceremony. Indonesian flag every Monday just like that. So Indonesian anthem and principle of Indonesia, the ideology of Indonesia is completely out of my head. But some people, older people, don't know, because take time for them to remember Indonesian song anthems or Indonesian principle like Pancasila. It takes time.
What are the five principles of Pancasila?
Well, as first one is believe in one God. A second one was, humanity. The third one was unity. The fourth one was democracy. And the fifth was social justice. So that's the point of five principles of the Republic of Indonesia.
Isn't that strange that they're democracy and social justice as you're being taken out of a car and you're being forced to say those, considering what's happening in your country?
Well, it is really strange, but in the other hand, you have no choice. Either you do it or you got tortured. So, like, that's why what I say is just the system Indonesianization that East Timor, young Timorese have to face. That's the thing what they try to do, by put us all of the ideology, by put us in our head all of the history of Indonesia, by force us to speak the language of our invader, by ban our language from school officially. East Timorese language is speak at home, but while they're around, you not speak your language. So the system of Indonesianization is really strong in East Timor too, and it's not just physical genocide the East Timorese people faced, but it is cultural genocide too. This was Bishop Bella was trying so hard to make sure that we're going to teaching Timorese people their history, their language. I hope that he succeed, he succeed, because there's no way that they will allow that happening.
Now, Bella, after the massacre, you chose to work with the Indonesian military until they chose you to study in Canada.
But also I've been through a lot of interrogation before I came to Jakarta. Like a couple of weeks of interrogation, and they forced my mother to sign a statement of responsibility while I was in Canada. And of course my family did, because that's the only way to get me out. So they signed a statement. And then when I came to Jakarta, one more month interrogation, training, how to speak, how to behave, how to represent Indonesia government in Canada.
Had you learned English at that point?
At the time, I start to memorize a few English, but it's hard to put in sentences. And I hardly make sentences in East Timor. I just know my name is, I came from East Timor, I live in Dili. Like, there's something that is very... But I remember how to say that the youth of East Timor see our future with Indonesian government. So please help Indonesian government. So please make sure that put pressure in the United Nations not to separate East Timor from Indonesia, because they're our future and we want to be part of Indonesia. That's kind of thing that they forced me to remember. And I did remember all of that. But of course I didn't say it because I already defected. And I could not say that and I will not say that because it's not true. Because I witnessed a lot and I have lost so many of my family and friends. And then for one month in Jakarta, it was a terrible time for me. I've been through a lot of interrogations and training, and I was behaved well, very well. So finally they sent me to Canada. And after a month in Canada, I defected.
How were you able to defect? What contacts did you have?
Well, when I came from Indonesia, I was hiding my uncle's address, like very small, in a very small paper, and I cut my new pants and I put it inside my pants. That's the way how I came to Canada with my uncle's address. And as soon as I got to Canada, I stayed in a hotel. Indonesian was looking for my suitcase, but they couldn't find the address because the pants were new. So I wrote a letter to my uncle in Brown University with the telephone number at the place I'm going to stay. So after 3 days, I got his telephone. He calls me. That's the time he organized everything. And then after I claimed my refugee status in Canada, they start to find out that I was in Canada. And then I learned English for about 3 months every day, and then practice every day and memorize English every day. And after 3 months, I start to speak out. I start to speak out about what is my message that's supposed to I give to people, not the lies that Indonesia asked me to say. So, and then since then, my family, of course, in big problem. They're in a big trouble because 5 of my brothers, they put in a prison for about a couple of weeks. And they gave me ultimatum, I have to return home by January 15, 1995. And I couldn't go because I defected. I know how what was like if you made Indonesia shy, ashamed in internationally. Internationally, they will like completely kill you. So I couldn't go. I just keep doing this work. And I think this is my dream, to, you know, make my work in reality, not hiding in underground movement anymore.
What are your plans now? What do you plan to do, and what do you see as the future of East Timor?
Well, I see that, we're going to win this struggle completely. I see that. I'm optimistically believe that East Timor is going to win. And also, as a Timorese people, I believe that because of the struggle that's going to win, let's see that we're not going to liberate East Timor, but we also have to free ourselves. And there is a lot of problem. Like, East Timor is not going to be perfect, you know. And we as Timorese people not to be too proud to take example from others. For example, I'm working with people from South Africa, from Guatemala, from El Salvador, from Burma. There's a lot of people that, you know, and we should not be too proud to be Timorese. As a Timorese, to be proud we know everything. For example, that our internal problem, for example, you can see that as a woman, for example, I don't think that we know a lot about our struggle. We know how to side by side with our fellow men to carry on our struggle. We need like political education. Through my perspective as a woman, I want to take more leadership in our struggle, not to be just, you know, follow our fellow men to show me what this is, that place is supposed to be, this is the rule you should play. No, I'm going to play my own rule because I know exactly what I needed. No man will know that what women need. I think women need know exactly what she needs. So that's, men should realize that.
Well, Bella Gallios, on this day before International Women's Day, we thank you very much for joining us. And by the way, the East Timor Action Network, which brought Bella Gallios along with Global Exchange to the United States, their number is 914-428-7299. That's 914-428-7299. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Errol Maitland, our engineer, executive producer, Julie Drizin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!